Hello, and welcome to North Shore Sports Night. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. I don't know where Tim Kearns is. I'm trying to make connections with him. He might be out scouting, for all I know. Mike Grenier is going to be here with us in a few moments, as we're going to kind of flip-flop our schedule and start with Basketball Insider in a couple of minutes. But we do have a few high school scores, and not a whole lot on this kind of fallish Monday as we head toward the stretch run in the spring. I mean, we're in the middle of May now, so only a few games left in each of the sports. The scores that we do have, as I said, few and far between. And by the way, that's going to be it. It's going to be kind of an abbreviated show tonight. Couldn't get a hold of some of the people we have been trying to, and that's understandable. It's kind of a busy time of year. In boys lacrosse, the only score we have in so far is Pentucket 17, North Reading 2. And for Pentucket, they are now 12-2. North Reading falls to 4-10. I don't have any particulars on any of these, except Guardy O'Flynn did send in something about the Ipswich girls tennis team that we'll get to in a few minutes. In girls lacrosse, Manchester Essex moves to 9-4 as they beat Georgetown 13-3. Georgetown is now 6-9 overall. Bishop Fenwick 10 and Reading 1. I don't have the records there. In softball, the only score we have is Woburn over Marblehead 14-2. And for Woburn, they are now 13-2 overall. Marblehead is at 6-8. In boys tennis, Beverly 5, Bishop Fenwick nothing, 5-0, Beverly in boys tennis. And in girls tennis, Ipswich 3, Rockport 2, and the Tigers now 4-6, the Vikings 2-11. And I'll see if I can find Guardy O'Flynn's report. Here it is. Ipswich got victories at number 2 singles from freshman Abby Allen, 6-1, 6-1. And from junior Tess O'Flynn, at number 3 singles, 6-3, 6-1. Senior captains Baylen Curtis and Maggie McCormick sealed a match, winning 6-love, 6-2 in doubles. So that's we appreciate the report from Coach Guardy O'Flynn, longtime coach in the area, well-known, of course, baseball, tennis, and other endeavors as well. We were hoping to have Kyle Gaudette on tonight from Newburyport, but he's kind of busy, and so we'll check in with him hopefully next week. He is the Newburyport Times sports editor, and we always appreciate his help. Very busy. And again, everybody's playing right now, so heading down the stretch run, as I think there are, what is this, maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks left of games. And if you look at the schedule, for example, I'm looking at St. John's Prep Boys Lacrosse, and I think in the latest power rankings, they are still... I'm not sure. This was, as of May 12, they were still number one. Let's see who this could
call
be.
Call from Massachusetts.
Oh, Mr. Kearns. Hello there.
Yo, boy.
We're on the air. You found your way.
I lost my phone. I've been packing for the trip.
Ah, okay. So when are you leaving?
Tomorrow evening.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. All right, that familiar voice is Tim Kearns. Tim, we're going to bring in Mike early tonight because we don't have another guest scheduled, so we'll probably keep this as an abbreviated program out of respect to your having to get ready to leave tomorrow. that's how it was.
When are you going to pack? When are you going to pack? I said, I don't want to put it all in there and get it all wrinkled.
I tell you, packing is not my thing, man. When we went down to Florida to visit the Proposkys, we were going to take carry-ons, and we were going to stay down there for one day each way. We're taken out of the schedule, and we were going to stay there for 6 days, so a total of 8 days covered. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to try to stuff my stuff into a carry-on. So I just got myself a big suitcase, and we checked it through, and it was well worth it. So I imagine you. Now, how long do you have to pack for? How many days?
Well, let's see. I think it's 10, almost 11 days by the time we get back.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, but you know, I can travel rather light. It's my other half that tends to travel a little heavy. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I use the example, we went away on a motorcycle, took the motorcycle away, and it was a full dress, so it had side bags, a trunk. I had a little trailer piece on it. I also had a trunk bag you put on the top of it. So I had the bag on top. I had all of my stuff bags.
Yeah.
The bag behind, and she sent a suitcase to each of our destinations. But we were going to Vermont first for 3 days, and then we were crossing over to New Hampshire to go to Laconia for 4 days. So with each friend, she sent a suitcase of clothes.
Well, we're the opposite here in this household because I take all my ski gear usually, even in the summertime. So I'm the one who takes all the big bags. So,
I tend to travel rather lightly. Yeah.
Not me. All right, Coach. Let's take our first break, and then I'm going to get a hold of Mike, and we'll talk some Celtics and other stuff too as we go on here. I was just mentioning that. Only a few scores in so far. I mentioned those. And St. John's Prep lacrosse not playing tonight, but they are still at number one despite losing a week and a half ago to Boston College High School. The Prep is at 13-1. BC High is at 12-1. And in the power rankings, D1 lacrosse, the Prep is right up there at the top. All right, so let's take a break. If I can find the right thing to do here. And there it is up there. And we'll be back with Mike Grenier and Tim Kearns in just a minute.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're planning to replace the windows in your home, I have just two words for you. Anderson Windows. Anderson is the most trusted name in windows throughout the United States. See the complete line of Anderson windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or visit us at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Here we go, guys. reintroductions here. Tim Kearns and Mike Grenier has joined us now, sports journalist. And Mike, we obviously have time to talk about stuff, and we're going to just be as comfortable as we want to be here doing this. Probably a half an hour or a little more. I want to start backwards. I want to start at the end. And then go back from there or wherever you want to go. And I want to start with this thing because so much has been talked about the Celtics-Sixers matchup and the series. It is one of the classic series when you look at the whole body of work. Yeah. And we can talk about that. But I want to just ask your opinion on how Joel Embiid reacted after the game because I thought he was all class.
You know, it's funny that you should mention that because I actually got three or four text messages saying, Mike, did you see that? Yes. You normally see players congratulate each other after a long and rugged series, and it always looks pretty sincere. You know, guys around the league know each other pretty well. But this was extraordinary, I thought, after Game 7. Joel Embiid, after quite a beating that the Celtics gave the Philadelphia 76ers, you know, the Celtics outscored them 33-10 the third quarter. They kept up the bombardment the fourth quarter. So they took a pretty harsh beating. Yet here was Embiid taking the time to not just congratulate players, but basically whisper in their ears who knows what he said to these players, because it will never be revealed. And you couldn't read lips because Embiid covered his mouth as he was talking. But he individually met with, obviously, most of the Celtics players. And to note in particular, he said he had a lot to say to Jason Tatum. He had a lot to say to Jaylen Brown. He had a lot to say to Marcus Smart. And who knows, but it looked like quite the conversation that he was carrying on with the Celtics various Celtics players. And, yeah, I would describe it as total class. That's the way that I reacted to it right after it happened. I thought it was unusual, more so than you normally see, what you normally see after a series. Tim, what did you take? What was your take on that?
You know, like everybody else, I think it sort of caught everybody by surprise. I think because a lot of times, you know, you see guys lose the last game and they're storming off the court. They're leaving the court early. They're down the runways. They're off the court.
And
here's a guy who, you know, just got voted the MVP of the league and basically dragged Philly to seven games, he along with Harden.
I agree.
To seven games when most people didn't think it would go five games. And to see him out there, and I only watched a little bit of the post game, but the one scene that I saw is he had grabbed Jaylen Brown, had his arm around him, and like you said, whispering in his ear. And you could tell there was just a sense of sincerity about whatever it was he was saying to Brown. And then, you know, gives him a hug and he taps him on the back and he walked away and he was looking, I think, for other Celtics to find to talk to. And I think Joe Mazzulla was one of those he was trying to find.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And it was a classy moment. And I have to say, and I know a lot of people thought it was really cool, but when Tatum hit the points for 51, and he's walking down the end of the court and the people are going crazy, and he's got both hands up going, yeah, more, more, more. I thought that was totally tactless, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So Bush League, something like, LeBron would do, or, you know, one of the other knuckleheads in the league. And I'm like, you know, you just set a record. You did something really great. You led the team to the, you know, to the two comfort behind wins after going up and going down and bringing them back from the edge. And then you pull that. You know, that's the state of sports today where, you know, let me hear your love for me. It's like, you know, they don't think they give it freely enough. You don't need to say, give me more.
Well, yes, and only that, Tim and Rick, but if you notice, I think it was when he scored that basket to make it 51 points total. He went back down the court holding up a 5 and a 1 to indicate to the entire world that he had scored 51. And, like, someone, I believe, on Twitter that I saw today, someone that I actually know, tweeted out, Larry Bird did that, meaning hit the three-pointers. However, he never did this, and they showed Tatum holding up the 5. In other words, Larry Bird did not have to explain to the entire world he scored 30 or 40 or 45 or whatever the case would have been. So I know exactly what you're saying, but obviously it's a different era, different kinds of fans, different kinds of players. And it is what it is these days. And he would probably be, you know, I'm not trying to defend him at all, but other players kind of do the same thing. I think also, too, though, Tim, not that I really mean to cut him some slack, but he was caught up in the moment of a big victory after being down the series 3-2, as you pointed out, and having a big last 5 minutes of game 6 to put him back in the picture. And then, obviously, he went off and went crazy in game 7. So I think part of it was the fact that the joyful moment of a win, but also trying to call attention to himself, which he didn't need to do, because the way the media is these days and TV and everything else, that satellite broadcast of 51 points was probably seen in China and many other places.
You know, I don't want to defend him either, but I got to say this. We cannot forget that, what is he, 25 or is he 26?
Correct, 25.
25. Think about that, all right?
Yeah,
I mean, this Red Sox rookie, Jaron Duran, he's 26. So, I remember Paul Pierce, when Pierce feigned an injury and he had to be carried off in a wheelchair and it was, oh, me. And he was a youngster at that time. And the thing that I keep thinking about is that I hear the media say, well, he's been in the league 7 years. So what?
Yeah.
So what? He's been coddled. He's been babysat. He's been admired and worshipped for 7 years. And he's only worked with Al Horford and a couple of these other guys, you know, for a very short time.
Right.
He's made some improvement.
Right, exactly. And he only spent a year at Duke and just 1 year. So he came out as a 19-year-old. So that's a pretty young age to be exposed to the NBA money and the NBA spotlight and all that stuff. So you can see where it go to his head. And going back to Embiid, because we should just check back with Embiid here and what he did. Embiid did this after seven games and a series in which he shot 20% on threes. 20%. And he shot 42% overall. Now, that's not; those are not MVP stats. I think part of it was he was still trying to play through an injury, and part of it was that, like Tim said, he dragged Philadelphia along with him. He was exhausted trying to play through an injury, and he hadn't played in a while, and he played six games in this series. But the Celtics' defense wore him down. And I think in many ways, when he was talking to those Celtics players, he was perhaps acknowledging what a great job they did on him defensively to make him work as he had to do for 39. He played almost like 39 minutes a game. So the Celtics really made him work, and his stats were way down from his previous series, from his regular season stats, way down. And you have to credit, you know, you have to credit Al Horford, you have to credit Marcus Smart, all the various guys that played against him, Robert Williams. I mean, they sent multiple defenders against him, and really Embiid was really a quiet offensive player in this series.
You know, Mike, I just put on ESPN and the NBA, and they're running some highlights from last night's game. And I'm looking at how many times Embiid was playing defense on Tatum out at the three-point arc at the top of the zone. And I'm thinking,
right. You
know, why are you making your big guy, a guy's got an injury, chase this guy out to the farthest extremes of the court to play defense and expend that much energy?
That's right, and that's exactly right, Tim, to my point that I think the longer the series went, he just, for Philadelphia, the coup de grace could have administered in game six because they had a lead in the fourth quarter and all that, and when they couldn't knock the Celtics out at home at the Wells Fargo Center, which, Rick, you know all about, when they couldn't knock them out at home, then, of course, they got off to, you know, Philly got off to a bad start in the first quarter at the Garden, it was all over, and Embiid did the best he could to get his team back in it. But he couldn't do it, and neither could Harden, who, of course, looked all of 33 years old. Talk about a Dow Jones up and down. You know, Harden had a 45-point game. He had a 42-point game. But he also had other games where he shot 3 for 14, 3 for 11, you know, 9 points in the game 7. And, you know, obviously he's another longtime All-Star. And he was off his game, too, because I think the Celtics ramped up the defense as the series went along.
I think there's no doubt about that. And the defense, to me, is the key to everything because their offense flowed nicely from the defense. And I think, you know, at this point, I wanted to ask you about Jaylen Brown and when he was being held there and got a technical foul.
Oh, my goodness. I'm wondering what the NBA rule is on that about maybe suspending an official because I have never seen in 50-something years of going to NBA games and all that, I've never seen a player on the bench grab an opposing player who was already in action on the court. And George Niang, from Methuen, Massachusetts, by the way, gave him, obviously, he tried to grab him by the kneecap, and he held him off for a fraction of a second. But still, you can't do that. That should have been automatic expulsion for the player, and it should have resulted in two technical foul shots for Jaylen Brown and the Celtics, and plus possession of the ball. For some reason, Scott Foster, the official, kind of a dingbat move, it gave a technical foul to Jaylen Brown. It was like just the opposite of what should have happened. I mean, eventually they, after going to review, they said, okay, Niang grabbed him and they gave the Celtics a couple of technicals. But however, it was the wrong call in the first place to assess Jaylen Brown anything.
and then later in the game, White gets called for a foul on a three-pointer and he basically turns his body and slides by the guy,
right.
But the referee underneath the basket, who has no view of the play whatsoever, calls it a foul with intent to injure, gives them three shots, and they got the ball back for a five-point play.
Right, exactly. Well, that's why they have those reviews, I think, Tim, at the end of the game. They always, the officials, I think, by rule, they take a look at the video of the last, especially the last 2 minutes of any game, and then they actually release the information about, well, the officials missed three calls on the 76ers and four calls on the Celtics. And it's always, I think it's up for grabs. They can actually get that information especially after important games. But I think most coaches don't want to dwell on that, win or lose, because the, you know, it's water under the dam, you know, and they can't get those plays back. So, but it's good that they review the officials, kind of keeps them on their toes. But fortunately, those calls that you mentioned, Tim, didn't cost the Celtics the game. In other words, it wasn't a close game. The Celtics had a big cushion, especially starting with the third quarter. They played so fantastic in the third quarter. Matter of fact, Tim and Rick, if you might recall, the 76ers scored a three-pointer to begin the third quarter, which means that the Celtics outscored them 33-7 for the rest of the quarter. 33-7.
Defense.
And, of course, you have the crowd going crazy. You had, you know, the Celtics playing great defense. You had Tatum going berserk. All those elements played into that steamrolling that happened with the Philadelphia 76ers.
Was Doc Rivers this much of a complainer when he coached the Celtics?
Well, you know, Doc has always been really a competitive guy, and, you know, he's had so many years in the league now. And, yeah, he fought for his team, similar to what he did here. But I think at the end, towards the second half of yesterday's game, Game 7, he was reaching. He was grasping at straws because his team was down 10, then it was down 15, then it was down 25. And he was grasping at straws just to try to reverse, you know, reverse the cycle, reverse everything that was going on. It was awful from a 76ers standpoint. I can't imagine he has too many friendly faces right now in Philadelphia because they did have the 3-2 lead and a home game, and it didn't happen for them, you know?
Yeah, it was funny. One of the articles on ESPN is, I think it was the owner and the head coach. The owner and the GM sitting down to talk about Doc's future with him. But, you look at the results. That's a young team coming up. There's a ton of talent. And, you know, you get him into the second round of the playoffs. So
right.
He's done a lot wrong on that team.
Exactly.
My brother had sent me a note after I'd seen the game, and I said, yeah, second half. And we were talking a bit, and I said, the thing they did is they never – let up. They never took the foot off the gas. They put the pedal down and they kept it down, and they didn't let up at all until the end of the game.
Right. Three and a half minutes left. Yeah.
And they gave Philly no chance to get back into that game, to get no offensive flow. They had to rush everything. The Celtics really filled in and rebounded defensively very well, and that just turned around and set them down the court.
Yep, absolutely. I agree with all that, Tim. Matter of fact, my one little complaint yesterday was the fact that Jaylen Brown and Tatum were still out there with like three minutes and 38 seconds left. They were up like 26 or 28. And even on the national broadcast, they were saying, why are those guys out there? Because there's always a chance of a freak injury, and you're playing the Miami Heat, who've been red hot, obviously, starting Wednesday night. So fortunately, about a half, maybe 10 seconds later, there was a deliberate foul or something like that, and it enabled Mazzulla to get in, you know, Muscala and all those other guys, and Sam Hauser and everybody else. But for a minute or two there, you held your breath because the two big boys, Tatum and Jaylen Brown, were still in there.
I want to put my son. Go ahead, Tim.
That hard foul ended up on his backside, and it was right after the network announcer said, "What are they doing out there? They could get hurt." And then back down he goes. I'm like, "Oh no."
Exactly. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I'm going to put my sunglasses on, and I want to focus on the bright shining light from yesterday. And I want to ask you, who have covered so many. What's that?
You going to talk about me now?
Yeah, Tim. Yes, yes. Yes, Jason. but I want to. I want to ask you, Mike, where this one ranks. In historic performances, because if you put this whole thing together now for the series, you put it in context. You know, Tatum had his ups and downs, he had his hots and colds, but except for one game, and especially the last two games, even when he was cold in that first half, he played, in my opinion, a complete game the entire length of the court.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it, because I think what we have to do is the overlap game, right, Rick? In other words, the last 5 minutes of Game 6, mm-hmm. when he scored like 16 points.
But he even played great defense and rebounding in that whole game.
Right, that's right. So when the money was on the line in mm-hmm. Game 6 and they were on the verge of losing, perhaps, mm-hmm. I remember it was like less than 5 minutes left. From that point on, he took over, and he scored 16 points, I believe it was, in the last 4 minutes. or last 4.5, 5 minutes of game six, which obviously led to, you know, a 9-point win. And then yesterday from beginning to end, and what I liked about game seven, Rick, and it was his assertiveness, taking it to the basket in the first quarter. He did not settle for 3-pointers. He got 16 points in the first quarter, I think it was, in game seven. And most of it came while attacking the basket, making acrobatic layups and getting fouled or getting fouled, you know. So he set the tone that way. And, of course, he finished with the 51, which was a game seven record in NBA history. Now, for a little historical context, Rick, 50 years ago, when the Celtics were playing the Atlanta Hawks in the playoffs, I actually covered John Havlicek's 54-point game in the Eastern Conference semifinals, the same round against the Atlanta Hawks at the Boston Garden. And, you know, that still is the team record. It's 54 points in a playoff game held by John Havlicek. And I couldn't believe my eyes yesterday because exactly 50 years ago,
wow,
April 1st, was Havlicek's 54-point game. It's just astonishing that it was bookended now by a Tatum's 51-point game 50 years later.
And how does this one rank in terms of Celtics history? You number
oh, yeah.
two?
I mean, it ranks up there. Well, I guess the story has not been finished yet because now you have to face the Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals, and then if they win that, obviously either Denver or the surprising Los Angeles Lakers in the Finals. But for what the way he's carried them through so far, I think it has to rank in the top. Off the top of my head, it has to be in the top five. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, Bird did some great things that led the championships game. We think of Cedric Maxwell saying, "Get on my back, boys, I'll carry you." One of the, you know, in the final, and then they won a championship. So, you know, it's up there. It's up there with a lot of the best games that we've ever seen from a Celtics player, especially in a big game situation, the playoffs. So, yeah, I think it ranks up there. I guess I'd have to go through every big game to see where in the top five or top ten, but it's up there. I obviously think of Dominique Wilkins versus Larry Bird in a fantastic back and forth, and they each scored 19 or 20 points in the playoffs in a quarter, that is, in a quarter, mm-hmm, as they went back and forth. The Celtics won that big playoff game, so it'll be a highlight for many years to come, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's been so many great performances, you know, in Celtic lore over the years. You know, Havlicek stealing the ball and, you know, to seal the victory. You know, going out in '69, going out to L.A. and leaving all the balloons up in the rafters.
Right.
You know, I always remember that one.
Oh yeah, you know? And here's one, Rick, because we have a good sense of history. Sam Jones, the great Sam Jones, scored 47 in a game seven.
Wow.
47
points. Wow, okay.
In 1963. So I guess you'd have to put that game in the Tatum category because there was a game seven, and you're talking 47 points in a game that was played 60 years ago, literally. So Sam Jones's effort has to be in that top five or six or four or whatever the case may be.
All right, why don't you preview the final four for us?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. Tim, we want to chip in on this one, too. You know, obviously the Celtics get the Miami Heat. Obviously they played them in the Eastern Conference Final a year ago. The difference being Miami had the home court advantage, and the Celtics showed their mental toughness by winning a Game 7 in Miami to get to the NBA Finals. Now this year, the picture's changed. The Celtics had a better record, much better record actually, and they have home court advantage should it come down to a seventh game. So I think the Celtics have phenomenal momentum as they head into this Eastern Conference Final. I think, obviously, Tatum has regained his game. Jaylen Brown has continued to play great. Malcolm Brogdon, by the way, shot like 53% on threes for this seven-game series. And, by the way, Jaylen Brown, you mentioned, Rick, we mentioned Tatum so much here, but Jaylen Brown shot 54% or 52% in a seven-game series here against Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So he's cooking. So I think they carry that over now into the Miami series, playing at home the first two games at the Garden. And I think Miami's thing is that obviously Jimmy Butler has been playing out of his mind. He had a 56-point game in the playoffs. He had followed that up with a 42-point game. That's 98 points in two games. He's playing as well as he ever has in his entire career. Obviously the Miami Heat are going to be missing Tyler Hero. Basically could average 25 a game, but he's out with an injury. And so he's going to be out. Adebayo is a very, very good big man. So the Celtics have to be, you know, careful with him. He can block shots. He can score 20, 25 a game. And I think the essential difference that Miami feels it has is that Eric Spoelstra is widely considered the top coach in the NBA. Just his overall savvy. He's won a couple of championships. He coached LeBron and Chris Bosh, that whole group, as a younger coach. And really, he throws all kinds of defensive looks at the Celtics. He will throw all sorts of defensive looks at the Celtics. Man-to-man, zone. He'll try to make the Celtics slow down by create these creative zones that he employs. He's an outstanding coach. He obviously must be a student of the game because he has a game plan and he'll stick to it in this, whether the series goes four games, five games, or seven. He's going to have a plan to slow down Jason Tatum himself. I guarantee you that. And of course, he's going against a rookie coach in Joe Mazzulla, who everyone's been critical of, and I've been in the eye of that storm, criticizing him quite a bit. But I'll tell you what, Rick and Tim, and I want to get your take on this. When he switched to a two big man lineup, I think it was in game six, putting Horford out there with Robert Williams, it made a difference both offensively and defensively. Horford, in particular on defense, played great, had some block shots, and on offense, by having Robert Williams dropping low near the basket where he could dunk the ball, well, Embiid could not go out and block shots that were taken in the paint by Marcus Smart or Tatum or Jaylen Brown, because as soon as he stepped away from the basket, they would lay it up, they would lay it off to Robert Williams for an easy dunk. So I think that strategy worked out great for Joe Mazzulla, and obviously I think he'll try to employ that against the Miami Heat in the finals here, Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, I agree, right. You know, I love the idea of, you know, Twin Towers working. We've seen it, you know, we've seen it in the past. Well, I mean, go back to the Celtics with McHale and Parrish.
Right.
I mean, what just hell with those two playing defense underneath the basket. And, of course, nowadays they're all playing zone, so, you know, you can cause even more havoc than before employing two big guys, especially, you know, if you've got big guys that can rebound, that can outlet pass, and then know enough to run the court, you know, to follow the ball and head to the basket. It makes such a big difference.
Yeah, but I really like the two big men, both offensively and defensively, what he did at the end of the series here, what Mazzulla did. I have to give him a lot of credit for that. Obviously, the guy who suffers because his playing time will go down is Derek White. And, of course, he's had a great year with the Celtics, and he's had some terrific playoff games. But it basically means that he kind of has to sit out at the beginning of the game. And, you know, but the beauty of that is you can call on Brogdon and Derek White to come off the bench. You know, so that's a good thing, too. But we'll see. It'll be like a chess game, like it always is between the coaches. And obviously, Mazzulla had his way with Doc Rivers in the long run. But I think Eric Spoelstra presents a different set of problems. And obviously, in many ways, the Miami Heat have nothing to lose. They were the number 8 seed. They lost the play-in game to the Atlanta Hawks, and then had to win a couple of games to even make the playoffs. So they're kind of playing with house money, so to speak. But they're a really good team. Really well coached. Duncan Robinson, who was a great story, played at Williams College, Division III, before he ended up going to Michigan and becoming a Division I player and then coming to the NBA, has regained his three-point stroke after having it missing all year. He's been playing terrific. He played really well against the Knicks. You know, so there's a lot of things that the Miami Heat do with players who aren't that well-known.
All right, what about the other conference?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. I as you know, Rick, I've been pointing out Jokic's great performances throughout the season. He really could have easily been the MVP in my estimation because he actually rebounds better than Embiid, and he's a much better passer than Joel Embiid. And I think the Denver Nuggets definitely are the team to beat in that series. The Lakers have come on strong. Give them credit. But really, when you look at Denver, Jokic is a walking triple-double. I mean, I've seen games where he gets 8 offensive rebounds and 21 rebounds overall, and he'll also have 14 assists and 29 points. He does that on a regular basis to the point where you start to take him for granted. And, of course, Aaron Gordon is a good inside scorer, and you have Jamal Murray, their second-best player. Sort of reminds you of a Jaylen Brown in the sense that he can get anywhere from 25 to 35 points on any given night. And he really is a great player that not many people know about. And then you have Porter Jr., who's a three-point shooter. They have more depth than the Lakers. So, and they have home court advantage because they were the top seed in the West all season. So I think I'd have to go with Denver in perhaps six games. And, you know, obviously I'm not discounting what the Lakers have done lately. You know, obviously LeBron still plays at a high level at age 38. And Anthony Davis, he kind of fluctuates between having great games and sort of having bad games. But they're a threat, obviously, but they won't have a home court advantage. I like Denver in that series.
Tim, final thoughts before you head off on your trip?
I just hope the plane's on time. That's what I hope, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's a good wish. That's a good wish, Tim.
Yeah. The weather looks good. It's going to be a little cloudy, but a lot of sun coming the rest of this week there. My wife is all panic-stricken. It's going to be cold. You know, like it'll be in the 60s, because she's already gearing up with winter clothes, you know.
Well, if the Celtics can dispatch the Heat quickly, maybe some of the Heat players will want to go to France as well.
There you go.
All right, boys. This has been fun. Let's wrap it up and wish Tim safe travels and, you know, calm seas and fair winds.
Well, I mean, Tim, do you speak French, though?
No.
No. Well, you know, good luck with that. Good luck.
You know, I know they can be a little hard-headed sometimes and only speak French at you just to confuse you. But I'll just speak English back to them, and that may confuse them as much as them confusing me.
Yeah, well, you know, Rick, Evan Fournier, who plays for the Knicks, he's from France. He speaks French very well. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to him. Now, they're out of the playoffs, so if you can text him or something or call him, maybe he can accompany you and be your interpreter.
Yeah, we should do that. See if he can.
Here we go.
Go ahead.
My sister-in-law, Alon, because she took she can speak French as well as Spanish. So, you know, we can go all over.
That's right. Well, have a great time, Tim, in all seriousness.
Well, thank you very much, as I appreciate it.
All right, Mike, we'll talk to you after the opener on Wednesday night.
Sounds great, Rick. Take care.
Thank you so much. Take care, Mike.
See you guys.
Coach, you be well, and you and Medium have a wonderful time.
I will do that. I know she will, too.
All right, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
All right, buddy.
Thanks, Tim. Take care.
Yeah, bye.
All right, that's Tim Kearns, who was our sports analyst and ambassador of goodwill, along with Mike Grenier, who was our basketball insider and sports journalist in general, obviously a specialist in all things basketball, but he knows a lot about everything. Anyway, thanks for joining us. Abbreviated version tonight. I'm Rick Moore for Bill Proposky and Bill Newell and Tim Kearns. Oh, don't forget, we have the Salem News Sportscast, the Salem News Podcast will be coming up tomorrow, and lots of good stuff there as we'll be back to the high school situation with Phil Stacey, Matt Williams, Nick Giannino, and Nick Kukuru, hosted by, of course, our own Bill Newell. That'll drop probably around 8 a.m. tomorrow. Don't forget that. And, of course, at the end of the week, around Thursday morning, around 8 o'clock, it is the Sports Desk program, the North Shore Sports Desk, and the Merrimack Valley Sports Desk with Nick Kukuru and Dominic Nicastro. So that's all here on MSO News Sports. Tell people about it. Our traffic's good. We have a lot of great news sources as we try to give voice to the North Shore. We want to have people on the North Shore in their own voices, and that's what we try to do here at MSO. So thank you for joining us. Do appreciate it. If you want to get a hold of us, it's at msonewsports@gmail.com. msonewsports@gmail.com. Thank you very much, and be well.